So, as most of you who are regulars know, I've been diving into the Buddhist Sutras lately, and tonight I want to offer you some thoughts on another one, which is the Sadaka or Acrobat Sutra from the Samyutta Nikaya. Okay. And by the way, as I was writing this, it really occurred to me that this particular sutra is very similar to one I offered 2 weeks ago, the Firebrand Sutta, and the talk after that on Groundhog Day, and the talk that's coming up next week on boundaries, and kind of diving into, I'm seeing a similar theme throughout all of these. And so you might think of this as talk number 3 in a series of 4, in a way. Before I continue, though, because it is my master plan, if you will, to continue a deeper exploration of the suttas this year, or at least add more of them to my talks, I wanted to give you all just a little bit of background for those of you who might be unfamiliar with these. So Nikaya is a Pali term for collection or volume. And so the Samyutta Nikaya, or grouped or connected discourses of the Buddha, is the third of the 5 Nikayas or volumes in the Sutta Pitaka. And the word Pitaka is Pali for basket, okay? And so the Sutta Pitaka is one of the 3 baskets of scripture that compose the Pali Tipitaka, or Pali canon of Theravadan Buddhism. And so when the Buddha was teaching about 2,600 years ago, he gave talks for about 45 years before his death. So it's a long time teaching. But the talks weren't written down. And instead, his teachings were passed on for hundreds of years after his death by the monks and nuns who memorized them, often by sharing the same stories, these suttas, the stories, and also by chanting some of the same verses so that they could remember them. It was an oral tradition. And when the teachings were finally written down about 500 years after his death, long time, it was by monastic councils who discussed and agreed upon what should be written down. So these approved, if you will, manuscripts were then scribed onto these long palm leaves that were stitched together, and they were stored in 3 literal baskets, so the pitakas, depending on what they were. And so when you take the Pali Canon or Pitaka all together, it can be helpful to remember which basket these are being pulled from, remembering that there are 3, okay? So the Vinaya Pitaka, the discipline basket, is all the rules that are for the monks and nuns, their conduct in the Sangha. And by the way, there are many, 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 many hundreds of more rules for the nuns than there are for the monks, which means things haven't changed a whole hell of a lot. Just saying. We're working on that. The Sutta Pitaka, or collected discourses, is the largest basket. And this is the Sutta Pitaka. It contains more than 10,000 talks that are attributed to the Buddha and also some of his closest disciples. And as you might imagine now, this particular basket is further divided into 5 volumes or Nikayas. And these include the long discourses, the middle-length discourses, the grouped or connected discourses, the further factored discourses, and the division of short books. And I'm sorry I'm giving you kind of a little history lesson tonight. I feel like I need a drawing board. But I think it might be helpful for you to just remember that kind of thing. You can look it up later if you're interested. The third basket is the Abhidhamma Pitaka, or the Special or Higher Teachings basket. And this is essentially kind of a miscellaneous assortment of commentaries about the Buddha's teachings, which, as you might expect, came later. So these are the commentaries, you know, what they think about the Buddha's teachings. And of course, there are different versions of all of these manuscripts. And honestly, they're all really best understood simply as story. They're meant to point to something that is true, but not necessarily to be taken as absolute truth. So important. So Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is considered the foremost modern translator of these texts, explains how we should read the suttas in particular. says, the text tells us that the Dhamma is not a secret or esoteric teaching, but one which shines when taught openly. It does not demand blind faith in authoritarian scripture, in divine revelations, or infallible dogmas, but invites investigation and appeals to personal experience as the ultimate criteria for determining its validity. The teaching is concerned with the arising and cessation of suffering, which can be observed in one's own experience. It does not even set up the Buddha as an unimpeachable authority, but invites us to examine him to determine whether he fully deserves our trust and confidence. God, I love that. The teacher Jack Kornfeld said something similar to this. He said, according to Buddhist teaching, the true Buddha is not limited to the body or mind of a particular man who lived long ago. This is illustrated by the tale of a young monk who had spent weeks sitting enraptured at the foot of the Buddha, gazing at his form and listening to his words. Finally, the Buddha chastised him, saying, "You do not even see me. To see the Buddha, you must see the Dharma, the truth. One who sees the Dharma sees me." Okay. So I hope that you can keep that in mind as we go along with the suttas and try not too hard to pin anything down, but just to open up to, you know, what feels true to you experientially through your own understanding and your own practice. Tonight I want to explore the Sadaka or Acrobat Sutta from the Samyutta Nikaya. And by the way, the suttas are often named because of the location where the Buddha gave the talk, where he first gave it. And so this one was given at a little Indian town named Sadaka, which is why it's the Sadaka Sutra. And this story or sutta is about two street acrobats who are performing together. And the first one is a man who is a master acrobat, and the second is his apprentice. And interestingly, so it's an odd sutra, his apprentice is a girl. And she has a really odd and unfortunate name, nickname of Frying Pan. Where that came from, but Frying Pan. Thousands and thousands of years she's been Frying Pan. And the version I'd like to read from you is from the teacher and scholar Andrew Olensky. It says, once in ancient India, a bamboo acrobat set up his bamboo pole in the center of a village, climbed up the pole with great agility, and balanced carefully on its tip. So if you can imagine, there's the master acrobat, and he's got this pole, and the girl is climbing up on top of the pole, right, that he's holding, and she's going to do some acrobats on top of this beam, if you will. It's a pole. He then invited his young assistant to scamper up and stand on his shoulder, saying to her, "You look after my balance, my dear, and I'll look after your balance. With us thus looking after one another and protecting one another, we'll show off our craft, receive some payment, and safely climb down the bamboo pole." "No, no, master, that'll never do," said the girl. "You must look after your own balance, and I will look after my balance. With each of us thus looking after ourselves and protecting ourselves, we'll show off our craft, receive some payment, and safely climb down the bamboo pole." And the Buddha said, what Frying Pan, the assistant, said to her master was the right way in this case. And by the way, the nuns, Buddhist nuns, tend to love this sutra because in this case, the girl was right. So the Buddha explains, looking after oneself, one looks after others. Looking after others, one looks after oneself. How does one look after others? By looking after oneself. By practicing mindfulness, developing it, and making it grow. How does one look after oneself? By looking after others. By patience, non-harming, loving kindness, and caring. So again, some of you might recognize a familiar theme that I've been using in my talks lately, which is that by taking care of ourselves, we therefore are taking care of others. Okay. And this seems really simple on its face to understand, doesn't it? We kind of get that. But it's actually often really difficult for us to put into practice or to truly understand it. And a lot of this comes from a cultural misconception that tells us that if we focus on taking care of ourselves, we're in some way being bad or selfish, right? Many of us, in fact, grew up with a strong belief that in order to be a good person, we really needed to be selfless, to care more about others than we do for ourselves. It's a cultural thing. So often there's a question, but if there is no self in Buddhism, doesn't this mean I should be selfless, right? And this too is a misunderstanding. When the Buddha talks about the concept of no self or anatta, he's pointing to the fact that we cannot locate a permanent, solid, reliable, pin-downable self that is unchanging, right? That's what he's talking about with anatta. We also can't find a self that is separate from everything else, a self that doesn't affect or isn't affected by everything else. We are all interconnected. It's also not saying that we aren't actual beings. You know, we all have names, and we're living here in this world, interacting with each other, affecting everything around us through our actions, right? We exist. We're affecting things. And this is what we have control over. Our own thoughts, actions, and behaviors, which relates to that idea of karma, that what we do and what we say and how we show up really matters, and it affects everything else. And the truth is, if we're not focused on taking care of ourselves, it's going to be not only harmful to ourselves, it's going to be harmful to others because we are all interconnected, okay? So we tend not to take care of ourselves in two main ways, which I talked about, I think, a couple weeks ago. The first main way we do this is that we maybe act in ways that are harmful or unskillful without really caring or thinking too much about how our actions and behaviors are going to affect ourselves and others. That's the first main way we do harm. But interestingly, the second way we do harm is that when we're believing that we need to sacrifice our own care and well-being and even our happiness for the care and well-being and happiness of others, okay? Many of you might remember these words from the Firebrand Sutta. One who is bent on the benefit both of self and of another is the chief and best, topmost, highest and supreme. So we need to really include ourselves in our circle of care. It needs to include both ourself and the other, right? It can't just be, it's all about me, and it can't just be, it has nothing to do with me, okay? It has to include both. So in the example of the Acrobat Sutra, you might imagine that if both the acrobat and his assistant are focused only on taking care of themselves at the cost of not caring about the other, they're both going to fall down, right? They're just taking care of themselves. But on the other hand, if they're both simply focused on paying attention to and taking care of the other at the expense of not being mindful about their own balance, again, they're both going to fall, right? So here the Buddha is suggesting that the two acrobats need to be mindful of balancing in such a way that, quote, by taking care of oneself, one takes care of the other, and by taking care of the other, one takes care of oneself. So I want to pause here just for a moment and say that the Acrobat Sutta is one of my favorites because it's so rich. It's actually, if you start digging into it a little more, it's so rich. And it's such a good example, an image. You know, here the Buddha is using the imagery of two people precariously balanced on a pole to describe how difficult this dance can be, how precarious and difficult it is, and how mindful, skillful, and attentive we need to be in order to establish and maintain a sense of balance and harmony, equanimity, so that the whole relationship doesn't come toppling over, which is so easy to do, isn't it? Think about any relationship you have with anybody, even acquaintances. you know, any relationship on any level with ourselves, others, the whole world, you know, society itself. So I find it interesting that even a simple, casual conversation with someone so often requires this kind of skillful balance so that it doesn't topple over into unkind or unskillful speech that might make or break the whole relationship, right? And this can extend out even further to things like working towards social change. Right? So in writing about the sutta, the famous monk Nanaponika tells us, if we leave unresolved the actual or potential sources of social evil within ourselves, our external social activity will be either futile or markedly incomplete. Therefore, if we are moved by a spirit of social responsibility, we must not shirk the hard task of moral and spiritual self-development. Preoccupation with social activities must not be made an excuse or escape from the first duty to tidy up one's own house first. Preoccupation with social activities must not be made an excuse or escape from the first duty to tidy up one's own house first. That's a hard one. So as you might imagine, in the Sutta of the Acrobat, the Buddha points to the importance of balance and equanimity, the fruit of the practice, in many ways. So first he's talking about the theme of physical balance, which relates to our practice about being embodiment, embodied in the body, rather than an out-of-body experience that is not tethered to the body itself. And through our own practice, as we become more and more aware of our own bodies in the present moment, what we're learning to do is be more centered in ourselves, in our real homes, more balanced and calm and focused, and aware and awake to everything around us, rather than being lost or unbalanced in the dream world of our distracted thinking. We're more present, we're more balanced and centered in our bodies, is what we're practicing. And when we're centered in our bodies, practice at being in our bodies, not somewhere else, we're going to be better able to recognize when we're starting to feel unsteady and we're starting to lose our balance. We'll recognize it quicker, okay? So maybe, for instance, we'll feel that sting of anger and recognize that we're about to say something snarky or unkind. We'll feel it quicker rather than after we've said that thing, right? Or, you know, we can more mindfully be aware that we're starting to have anger and bring ourselves back to home, to the heart, and to compassion, and to our bodies, and to calm, right? Or maybe, for instance, we're noticing that in our bodies we're really running, we're going too fast, we're banging into things, we're dropping things, right? We're looking at our cell phone when we're supposed to be driving, or we're getting distracted by stuff, or we're going too fast in our bodies. In that moment, we recognize maybe we're fearful or distracted and that we really need to slow down before we might do something harmful to ourselves or others. But if we're too interested in taking care of someone else, focused on what they're doing, or preoccupied about how someone else should be living their lives, or maybe even blaming them, or something, if that person only did this, if they would only be this way, or, you know, we're not going to be able to notice what's going on in our own bodies. We're not going to be centered because we're going to be out of body, if you will, preoccupied with other bodies, that other person. And when we're not taking care of our own bodies, the places where we live, when we're letting them get too tired, exhausted, burnt out, maybe, or run down, unhealthy, or maybe, you know, we harm them by putting things into them like alcohol or drugs, we're really not going to be helpful, as helpful, to not only ourselves, but to anybody around us, right? When we're tired or grouchy or drunk, right? So we're going to be literally unbalanced, like a person who's drunk and can't walk that straight line. or maybe like the person who's driving drunk, which we can all recognize is a strong example of putting both self and others in danger, isn't it? The same goes for our inner balance, which means a balance or centeredness in our own heart and mind that keeps us from acting out on our more primitive impulses of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. Those three poisons can be just like drinking alcohol, drinking poison. So I really like the way Nana Ponika talks about this, about working on our own inner balance as a way of protecting others from harm. I think that's a really important point. And it's a little longer, but I want to read this. He says, if we permit the three roots of evil, greed, hate, and delusion, to take a firm hold in our hearts, then their outgrowths will spread far and wide like a jungle creeper, suffocating healthy and noble growth all around. But if we protect ourselves against these three roots, our fellow beings too will be safe. They will be safe from our reckless greed for possessions and power, from our unrestrained lust and sensuality, from our envy and jealousy, safe from the destructive consequences of our hate and enmity, which may be destructive or even murderous, safe from outbursts of anger and from the resulting atmosphere of antagonism and conflict, which may make life unbearable to them. As to the third root of evil, delusion or ignorance, we know very well how much harm may be done to others through the stupidity, thoughtlessness, prejudices, illusions, and delusions of a single person. History shows us that great and destructive mass delusions have often been kindled by a single individual or a small number of people. Self-protection through wisdom and knowledge will protect others from the pernicious effects of such influences. I'm going to let that sit there for a second. So the idea here in the sutra is that as we work on protecting ourselves from the pain of our own greed, hatred, and delusion, we are in essence protecting everyone else from this kind of negative karma, right? From our actions. As Nana Ponika explains, someone who is patient towards others, quote, will protect himself better than he could with physical strength or any mighty weapon. And I want to pause here again for a second and remind us that we are all human, just as a reminder, and that we are all going to lose our balance sometimes. Maybe every day we're going to lose it, you know, and do something unskillful that we regret. You think about something you did today that you regret? You know, I can. Just minor things. Might be a big thing, might be just a minor thing. We do it every day. We lose our balance. We lose our presence. We lose our mindfulness. Or compassion, or, you know, we get angry, we get envious, we're human. And so we need to be kind to ourselves. We also need to remember that when we're really stressed out, or when we're ill, we're not feeling well, or we're tired, we tend to fall back on our old habits and behaviors more quickly, and tend to cause either ourselves or others harm. So when we're not balanced, when we're out of balance in some way, we're more quick to react in habitual ways rather than respond, mindfully respond. So we can kind of give ourselves a break when, you know, we're tired or we're ill, if we can remember, you know, I'm just unbalanced right now. Which is why the Buddha here, I think, is really emphasizing this idea of practicing balance, really being practiced in calm, being steady, especially when we find ourselves carrying something heavy or unstable or unpredictable, right? So the acrobat is carrying something on their shoulders that they have to be mindful about. It's heavy, it's unstable, it's unpredictable, right? The teacher and scholar Andrew Olenevsky describes it this way: mindfulness is a tool for looking inward adjusting our balance, and staying focused on the still center point upon which everything else is poised. The quality of the present moment of awareness, that bamboo pole upon which we all hover, can be calm, stable, and focused. And what it is, our well-being and that of all those who depend on us, is well protected. So along with practicing being balanced and centered, we also need to be really mindful of constantly trying to cultivate a sense of caring for both ourselves and others. So this means very consciously and deliberately practicing patience, non-harming, loving kindness, and compassion for both ourselves and others. All those things the Buddha mentioned. One of my teachers I've studied with many times, Bhikkhu Anālayo, says that when we're practicing the teachings of the Acrobat Sutta, what we're really doing is practicing dana, or generosity, in the sense that we are offering or giving others our patience, kindness, and compassion, along with an assurance that we aren't going to harm them. That's what we're offering them. Which is really the opposite, isn't it, of, you know, when we're offering others our greed or our aggression or our deluded thinking or our envy. You ever been the recipient of envy? You know, or even think of anything. When you're a recipient of greed, that's what that person has offered you. So the Buddha is saying we're offering them a kind of trust. Kind of trust. So as we practice interacting with others, we might, for instance, focus on our intention to practice these things within ourselves so that we can then offer this out to others, that we can be that kind of calm and balance, right? Many of you may remember this quote from the Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh, who wrote, "When the crowded refugee boats met with storms or pirates, if everyone panicked, all would be lost. But if even one person stayed calm, it was enough. It showed the way for everyone to survive." So as we practice this, as we have this as our intention, as we become that balanced, kind, compassionate, centered presence in the world, the more people are going to begin to trust us, right? They're going to be more willing, if you will, to climb up on our shoulders, trusting that we're going to be able to offer them that calm, steady presence, that mindful presence. And we're also going to do our very best not to harm them. I'm going to do my best not to let you fall. People will trust that. But you're not going to go stand on the shoulders of a drunk, right? Keep using that word drunk. But what I mean by that is drunk in the mind and the heart and the body. It doesn't necessarily mean alcohol, right? You know, maybe finally then they're going to be willing to listen to us and trust what we have to offer. But maybe not before that. Remembering again, this does not mean that it's now our job to save them. Really important. What we're offering is our patience and kindness and care. And the rest is really up to them. It's really up to all of us to do our own inner work. Sadly, we can't fix people. We can't. And in the sutra, the Buddha calls attention to the fact that we really can't control the balance of others. And he suggests that trying to do so is not going to work. I can't control your balance. I can only control mine. So we can have a deep compassion for someone who is currently unbalanced or maybe struggling or maybe isn't a very good acrobat right now in the moment. But we can't carry them at our own expense. We can't carry them at our own expense. So the only control we do have is over ourselves and our own practice. And this affects everything. So for instance, if the master acrobat in the sutta is constantly wobbling and tiring himself out in his attempt to control his assistant's balance, she's going to be more likely to wobble herself and fall off. He's trying too hard to do everything for her, right? But if he works to maintain his own sense of calm and balance and focus, it's absolutely going to affect the balance of his assistants. That's what he's offering. I'm offering you my calm, steady presence. He's also constantly working to maintain his own balance in response to hers, and she to him. And when the two of them are doing this mindful dance together, that's when there's true harmony. So when discussing the sutta, Dharma teachers often point to the relationship between parent and child for this. So for instance, sometimes parents can lecture their children over and over and over about what they should do or how they should be, but nothing is going to influence the child's development more than the parent's own example, right? So when the parent practices being patient, non-harming, loving, and caring, the child learns to trust in those sturdy shoulders, if you will, rather than just trusting the words or the rules that are spoken, which are actually often not exemplified by the actual actions. So we can also sometimes take on the role of parent for other adults in our lives, and we can do this in many ways, right? Maybe trying to fix someone in some way, or trying to control how we think they should be living their lives, or trying to save or rescue them at the expense of our own well-being. We're exhausted from trying to take care of or fix this other person. As I was doing some research for this talk, I came across an article by Eileen Cohen, who's the author of When It's Never About You, The People Pleaser's Guide to Reclaiming Your Health, Happiness, and Personal Freedom. And what struck me was this line. She said, I finally realized that if I kept taking on other people's anxiety as my own, they would never change. And why would they, after all? They got lots of relief from me stepping in and resolving things. But at what cost? But at what cost? So as it relates to the sutra, you might imagine how difficult it would be for the master acrobat if he continued to try to take care of his apprentice as she was doing all sorts of things, right? Causing the two of them to become unbalanced. You can imagine how much of a toll, if you will, that would take with her on his shoulders and him putting all the effort into trying to keep the two of them balanced all by himself. He wouldn't be able to do the important work of balancing himself. So again, to quote Andrew Olensky, says, life itself is a balancing act. We are each of us perched upon a precarious pole, trying to stay centered in a swaying, breezy world. It is difficult enough staying safe ourselves, let alone trying to keep track of all the things stacked upon our shoulders. I really like that. And finally, just to end, I'll leave you with another image from the suttas, from the Jataka Tales, which tells a story about a monk who was traveling in a caravan, and when the caravan camped out for the night, he went out and practiced walking meditation throughout the night. And the robbers who were intending to rob the caravan thought he was a watchman and didn't dare attack. So that's a good example of taking care of himself. He took care of others. So I think I'll end there and just invite you all into a brief sit as a contemplation tonight. So just coming back into a nice seated posture. And just taking a nice deep breath in, deep breath out. And just coming into the body, being embodied in the body and mind, heart. Really settling here in your own body. Maybe starting even to get a sense of being grounded, connected to the earth, centered. What would it feel like to be balanced and centered in the body? I'm going to invite you to consider some questions. And the first is, what or maybe who might you be carrying on your shoulders that is taking you away from your own balance. Could be a what or a who. That is taking you away from your own balance. You might consider, how might you find some more balance for yourself? How could you discover more balance? Maybe it's not something you need to be carrying. Or maybe you're becoming unbalanced in some way and need to set something down. Or show up in a different way. How could you show up with more patience, kindness, and compassion to yourself and to others? What would that look like? You might even consider, what am I offering others? What is it really that I'm offering when I show up? You might even consider, what might I want to offer myself? How am I showing up for myself? Might I be able to offer myself more of my own patience, kindness, and compassion and care? So I'd like to invite those of you who'd like to just place a hand on the heart and maybe a hand on the belly, breathe into the fingers. And see if you can set an intention for yourself. And how can you find more balance in your own life? An intention for yourself. For finding more balance. just listening to these words from Thich Nhat Hanh, who writes, "You are me, and I am you. Isn't it obvious that we inter are? You cultivate the flower in yourself so that I will be beautiful. I transform the garbage in myself so that you do not have to suffer. I support you. You support me. I am here to bring you peace. You are here to bring me joy." I hope you enjoyed this talk. These talks are always offered freely so that no one is ever denied access to them. And your support, or dana, also makes a big difference. Dana is the ancient Pali word for spontaneous generosity of heart. If you feel inspired to support these talks by offering dana, you can do so by visiting my website at www.mindfulvalley.com. Thank you so much.